Back to why civilians shouldn't be involved in police investigations. Flora's actions Friday night had led to Goulding's death, eliminating the police's best source of answers. Detectives knew better than to burn a person of interest alive. Apparently, vigilantes didn't. Tonic is a nightclub. I doubt it's even open this afternoon, Dee Dee hedged, while she tried to decide if Rosa's proposed visit was the best or worst idea she'd ever heard.
I spoke to the manager. She's agreed to meet me there at 4.
Rosa had called the bar's manager. But of course. And you reviewed this plan with Dr. Keynes?
I asked him to come with me. He has insight into my daughter that I value.
Sure, insight into the daughter, Dee Dee thought cynically. Except the moment she thought that, she found herself uncomfortable again. Keynes had feelings for Rosa. Dee Dee was positive. Spoken, unspoken, returned, unreturned, who knew? But did that alone explain his level of involvement?
Samuel recommended that I contact you as well, Rosa was saying over the phone. Something about how territorial local detectives can be. How you might not view my actions as helpful, but threatening. He advised me to be respectful. I'm going with Honest.
Apparently. Dee Dee frowned, glanced again at the lab report on her desk. Fine, she said abruptly.
Rosa wanted to visit Tonic?
Well, so did Dee Dee. So why not kill two birds with one stone? Visit the nightclub Flora had been investigating while also spending more time with the girl's mother.
I'll meet you there at 4. Bring Dr. Keynes as well. He can offer more of his professional insights.
Rosa didn't say goodbye or thank you. She simply hung up. As she'd said, not ready for respectful, but at least being honest. Dee Dee grabbed her jacket, headed out. Dee Dee had never been a nightclub sort of girl. A good Irish bar she appreciated, but blackout surfaces, strobe lights, loud music, not really her style, even when she'd been young and, supposedly, hip. It was always interesting, she thought, to visit such places by the bright light of day, sort of like catching a movie star without her makeup on. At night, with the lighting just so, and the floor crammed with writhing bodies, and the stage dominated by the next up-and-coming band, the place probably felt electric. 4 p.m. on a Monday, it reminded her more of a college student with a hangover. The floor was sticky and covered in shredded cocktail napkins. The dark painted walls were scratched and dinged, the bar area tired. The place looked like it could use a refurbishment, or at least a break from its high-risk lifestyle. Rosa and Keynes had arrived first and were already talking to a woman near the back. They made quite a trio, Rosa in her usual yoga grunge, Keynes in his classic gray suit, and the manager in nightclub black-on-black. Currently, the dark-haired manager had her eyes locked on Keynes. He wasn't even talking, and she still stared at him, entranced. Apparently, Keynes's cheekbones worked even on a woman surrounded by pretty and even prettier staff. Dee Dee walked up. She flashed her credentials, purely to establish dominance, because yes, she was that petty. No dice. The manager kept her attention fixed on Keynes. On the other hand, Keynes smiled slightly, as if he knew exactly what Dee Dee was doing and appreciated the effort. "Sergeant Detective Dee Dee Warren," Dee Dee spoke up crisply, never one to back down from a fight. The manager finally dragged her attention away.
"Jocelyn. Jocelyn Ethier."
"You're the manager?"
"Yes. I've worked here 5 years."
"Were you here Friday night?"
"Yes. I split my time between the back office and, of course, making frequent tours of the floor just to make sure things are going smoothly. I recognize the picture of her daughter."
She flicked a sad, nervous glance at Rosa.
"I noticed her at the end of the night when things were winding down. She was out on the floor, still dancing."
"Did you happen to see who she was with?" Dee Dee asked.
The manager shrugged.
"There was some guy holding a beer, watching her. I assumed they were together. She was out of his league, I can tell you that, but..." She shrugged again. "What did the guy look like?"
"Average. Khakis, long sleeve, light blue button-up. Like a wannabe finance guy or something. Not really much to look at."
Dee Dee nodded. That was consistent with what they knew thus far.
"I understand Devon had worked here for the past 3 years.
"Yes,"
The manager's face shuddered. Devon, excellent bartender, reliable, which is tough enough around here, but also, he had the look. We're a nightclub. Appearances matter. He worked out. Dee Dee supplied neutrally. He did. His chest. Women and men lined up for at least one more drink. The manager still didn't look up. Uncomfortable about talking about a recently deceased employee? Or something else? He mind the male attention? Dee Dee asked. Not that I could tell. My impression was that he worked pretty hard to look the way he looked, and he enjoyed showing it off. He have a girlfriend? Not that I knew of. And you and he... Dee Dee let her voice do the asking. No, the manager said flatly. I run the asylum. I don't frequent with the inmates. There was an edge to her voice, however, that spoke of a lesson learned the hard way, a woman scorned. What about Natalie Draga? Dee Dee switched gears. Natalie, she worked here, briefly. I think I showed her file to one of your other detectives. Did she know Devon? Would have been hard not to. He was one of our regular bartenders. She was around for at least a couple months. As for fraternizing, backroom staff hookups are about as common as front room players. Anything's possible. What about Christy Kilker? Who? Dee Dee flashed a photo. The manager shook her head. I don't recognize her. The volume of people who pass through here on any given night, however, I'm only familiar with the regulars. You didn't know Stacy Summers? Rosa spoke up. No. But that doesn't mean she didn't come here on occasion, Rosa supplied. It's possible. Like I said, the volume of people in a night. The manager shifted uncomfortably again. Of course, what happened to her? That video of her abduction on the news? It's every manager's nightmare. We made some changes to our procedures immediately. Really? Dee Dee interjected sharply. Because given what your own bartender did on Friday night... F.E.A. stiffened, her expression turning wary. I didn't know. Okay? Is that what this is about? Because I've already told all this to the first detective you sent over. No, I didn't suspect my own bartender was a rapist. No, I didn't realize Devon had ambushed some girl on Friday. He left abruptly, didn't come back. Was I pissed? Yes. But did I think... Did I imagine... She thinned her lips. This is a hard job. The amount of turnover in staff, vendors, customers, I don't know everything that goes on. No matter how hard I try, I can't know everything that goes on. Do you know the staff at other nightclubs, such as Birch's? Keane spoke up. In contrast to the manager's heated voice, his tone was perfectly neutral. The woman's shoulders relaxed marginally. She conceded to meet his gaze. Sure, the industry isn't as big as you think. The bartender fired from Birch's today will most likely be asking me for a job tomorrow, so it's good to be able to compare notes. Nigel is the head manager at Birch's. He's been quite distraught by the Summers case. F.E.A.'s voice grew defensive again. We try to keep an eye on our customers, you know. Bartenders, staff, the door attendees, everyone is trained to be aware of who's had too much to drink, who might need a ride home. Something like the Summers case? It's bad for all of us. You noticed Flora on Friday night. Keane's again, voice still calm. You saw her on the dance floor. You paid attention. As you say, that's your job. F.E.A. didn't speak. And yet, when your bartender exited the door after her... I didn't see that. Why not? It was 2 a.m., closing. There were a million things going on. I wasn't even out front anymore. I was in the back, working on receipts. What about cameras? Dee Dee spoke up. From your back office, surely you can watch live video streams from the dance floor, bar area, entrances and exits. Standard operating procedure for most clubs. The manager flushed, said nothing. You do have cameras, Dee Dee pressed. Of course. But I checked for the first detective who stopped by. The, cameras weren't working that night. What do you mean, weren't working? They were turned off, shortly before closing. And who did that? I don't know. What do you mean, Ms. F.E.A.? Keane's again, working his Zen voice. Is this the first time the cameras had been turned off? The woman shook her head. She looked either guilty or distraught. Dee Dee couldn't decide which. Keane's continued on. How many times before? And who would have access? I started noticing it around a year ago. A night here, a night there, except the past few months. Ethie took a deep breath. She glanced at Keynes, as if pleading for understanding. I was beginning to have suspicions.
Suspicions of what?
It was too often, too regularly. I should have reported it to HQ, maybe installed a lock on the closet containing the security system. I had my suspicions, maybe drug deals or theft, but not kidnapping. You have to believe me. Not assault, not that. But yes, someone was tampering with our system. I did know that.
You're a good manager, aren't you, Miss Ethier? You can't see everything, as you said, but you try. So you noticed. You have been noticing something with your staff was off.
Ever since Natalie...
What about Natalie?
Dee Dee let Keynes take over the questioning, because he'd roped the manager in now. She was making direct eye contact, staring right at him, and Dee Dee could already tell what the manager had fed them the first time around regarding Natalie Draga had been the party line. Now, finally, they were honing in on the truth. Employees come and go, that's true, and they don't always leave forwarding information. But to not pick up a check? Who doesn't pick up a paycheck? And I suspected that she and Devon had a thing. Not my business, but again, if she was with him, all the more reason to stay, you know? Keynes nodded. But she didn't come in. Left work one day, never showed up again. And Devon? He wasn't sad. Wasn't distraught. If they had a thing and she suddenly split town, shouldn't he have been upset? Keynes nodded again. But he wasn't. If anything... He seemed cheerful.
You wondered about Devon Goulding, Keynes said.
There was nothing I could do, the manager expelled in a rush. I never saw anything wrong, heard him say anything inappropriate, but just his moods, these flashes of rage. I don't know, Devon didn't seem like Devon anymore. He seemed darker.
And that hurt her, Dee Dee filled in the blanks, because at one time Ethie had felt as if she knew him well.
Intimately. She'd been involved with him, whether she was willing to admit it or not.
Did Devon have access to the security system? Keynes asked, gently.
Yes.
You believe he was the one who turned it off Friday night?
Ethie looked at Dee Dee. She exhaled, a confession of sorts. Yes.
You noticed my daughter Friday night. Rosa spoke up abruptly. You said you saw her dancing, but you've also said you can't track everything. So why did you watch my daughter?
Ethie flushed. The way she was dancing, she was calling attention to herself, but also... She seemed alone.
You worried about her, Rosa provided.
Again, that faint hesitation. I checked in on her. I wanted to make sure she was all right.
Dee Dee got it. You wanted to make sure she hadn't caught Devon's eye.
She was dancing with another guy, I swear. She was dancing with Mr. Normal. So then I stopped watching. I counted receipts instead.
Dee Dee leaned forward. Stacy Summers, she prodded. Think. Now is the time. When you saw the video of Stacy Summers, did you recognize her as one of your customers? Is there any chance she also knew Devon Goulding?
God's honest truth, detective, I have no idea. I am so sorry, but I have no idea.
Dee Dee nodded, stepped back. Rosa and Keynes did the same, while the manager, Ethie, remained standing there, looking like a woman who'd just taken a beating, and her work shift had yet to begin.
One last question, Dee Dee said. Does this place use any glitter?
Restrooms. Tonic offered up a basket of toiletries for its patrons, male and female alike. Dee Dee and Rosa did the honors in the ladies' room, while Keynes took the men's room. Dee Dee found what she was looking for almost immediately, a hair gel product laced with gold glitter. She gave Keynes a quick call to learn he'd discovered the same. Nothing like a bit of sparkle for the discerning clubber with a big night ahead. She held the gel under the overhead lights, watching the way the various gold particles shimmered. As Alex had said, the pieces appeared individual, distinct. And sticky.
Chances were, even after hand-washing, showering, minute pieces of the gluey sparkle lingered for days, just waiting to be transferred from a kidnapper's hands to a victim's apartment, or even her body. Dee Dee dialed Ben Whiteley, who most likely was still exhuming the body at the nature park. He picked up the call, as charming as ever.
"Whatever it is you want, I don't know. I didn't know 5 hours ago, I don't know now. And if you don't leave me alone long enough to finish wrapping up the scene and transport the body to the lab, I may never know anything ever again.
I need you to check something for me.
Dee Dee,
it will just take a second. Can you shine the flashlight on the body's hair? Look for gold, as in glitter.
The hair is brown and completely saturated in dirt. How do you expect me to...
Wait. There do appear to be some reflective particles.
It's possible I'm looking at glitter.
Can you remove a small sample? I'm going to send a uniformed officer to you immediately for pickup.
Thank you, Ben.
Dee Dee clicked off the phone, stood there thoughtfully. Rosa came up behind her. The woman appeared tired, but was in control, as always.
The glitter is important?
Yes.
What does it mean?
It means... Dee Dee shrugged, still fumbling her way through a case with more questions than answers. It means my husband was right. Natalie Draga, Christy Kilker, Stacy Summers, your daughter. All of their disappearances are connected. She looked at Rosa. The glitter tells us so.
Chapter 35. Laughing. Jacob had a joint. They passed it back and forth between the two of them, heads bowed close together, giggling like schoolgirls. I sat alone at the tiny kitchen table, rubbing my bare arms for warmth, watching them in the family room. Turned out the new girl wasn't new at all. She'd recognized Jacob, threw open her long, creamy arms in greeting. He'd wrapped her in a tight embrace. A hug. Jacob hugged her. I hadn't been hugged. In a very long time. Not since the days of the woman who looked like my mother and wore a silver fox charm around her neck. At first, Jacob had been reluctant to enter the yard.
Nah, he'd said. She told me last time she caught me that she'd call the police. That'd be it. Back to the slammer, and we both know I ain't never going back there.
Then it's a good thing she's not around, the new girl had said, hands still on Jacob's shoulders.
Come on now. You don't need this kind of headache. I was just in the area. Wanted to say hey.
Hey, she said, and I swore his eyes glittered with tears.
I don't mean to bother you, he whispered. You were right last time. I'm an ass. I should just stay away.
But he wasn't moving, and neither was she.
I was mad, she said suddenly. Last time I saw you, the things you said, I wasn't ready to hear. Maybe I didn't want to know. But I've been doing some thinking since then. Sometimes I even hoped you'd stop by again so we could talk. 'Cause I think maybe there's some truth in what you said.
What do you mean?
You know what I mean.
Lindy.
Come inside. Come on. Just have a visit. We'll catch up. This time I'll listen. I promise.
But if she...
She's not coming back. I'm telling you the truth. She's gone, and she's never coming back again. That seemed to do the trick. Jacob stopped resisting. He followed the beautiful girl across the burned-out yard. I trailed behind the two of them, already forgotten. I hated this new girl who wasn't new. I hated her long, dark hair. I hated her gleaming, brown eyes. I hated the way she smiled at me, as if she already knew things I didn't, such as I was the one just passing through. She would always be the real deal. The house was shabby, dirty stucco-colored linoleum in the kitchen, tired cabinets with sagging doors, furniture patched with silver splashes of duct tape. It made me feel better. Some basic female instinct, at least my house is nicer than yours. Except, of course, I didn't have a house. I had a coffin-shaped box in the back of Jacob's sleeper cab. I couldn't breathe. I didn't know why. My throat was closing up, my heart rate too high.
Jacob, holding the knife down at his side, now drinking and smoking with this girl, the legendary Lindy, whom he talked about in his sleep. They were together, before, now, forever. She would always be his, which made me completely expendable. Gator food, literal white trash. I was going to be sick, except I hadn't eaten enough lately to vomit. My hands trembled, my left knee jogged uncontrollably. Stress, fear, fatigue, hunger. Take your pick. I suffered, suffered, suffered. While Jacob sat on the sofa and laughed and smoked dope with the most beautiful girl I'd ever seen. I don't know when I first moved. I just did. Stood up at the table. Not like they were paying attention to me. Walked toward the jumbled collection of broken-down drawers, sagging cabinets. A ratty kitchen. A shabby kitchen, but still a kitchen. And every kitchen stocks similar items. Such as knives. The paring blade, short and easy to conceal. Or maybe the butcher knife. Go full psycho. In the end, I selected a model in between. Without ever truly thinking about it. If the new girl wasn't really new, then I could make a decision without really deciding. Giggles. High-pitched. Happy. And just for one moment... I am home. I am rolling on a bed, all tangled up with my mother, my brother. We are laughing, laughing, laughing. This is Mom. This is Mom, all cracked up. The softness of the down covers, the smell of spring rain and loamy earth right outside the window, the sound of my mom, my brother, laughing hysterically. Home. Home, home, home. Snapping back. I looked down at my pale, skinny arm. I studied my hand holding the kitchen knife, and I realized then, truly got it, that I wasn't going home again. I would never roll on that bed. I would never laugh with my family. I would never go to that place. I would never be that person. That girl was dead. All that was left was this moment, this place, this knife in my hand. I held out my left wrist, studied the maze of red scars, blue veins. It would be so easy. One swipe here, one swipe there. Leave Jacob to clean up the mess. Gator food. Literal white trash. My mother never knowing what happened to me. Denied even the comfort of burying my body. She deserved better. So for her sake, as much as my own, I took my knife and drifted into the family room. They didn't see me coming, too busy whispering and giggling, reminiscing about the good old days, whatever. Their heads were bowed, Jacob's hair gray-streaked and greasy, hers dark and silky. It made it easy to launch the first strike, my arm raising all the way up, just like every slasher film I'd ever seen, except this time I was the crazy-eyed stalker instead of the doe-eyed college student. Nobody wants to be a monster. Or do they? Arm coming down, 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 a scream, sharp and shrill. Mine? Nope, definitely hers. The beautiful new girl came shooting off the sofa, blood blossoming down her back where I had raked the knife across her shoulder blade. Shit! Jacob exploded, fear just beginning to penetrate his doper's glaze. What the fuck? What the f... I turned to him next, arm up, 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 arm coming down, down, d... She launched herself at me. The new girl, who wasn't new, fought like a hellcat. She tackled me down to the ground, fingernails slashing down my face, going for my eyes, screaming words at me in a language I didn't know, not Spanish, something far more exotic. As I heaved against her reflexively, forgetting all about the kitchen blade which had scattered from my grip. But she didn't. Her gaze flashed to the knife, resting several feet away, her face sharpening with a look of cunning. I realized what she was going to do the second before she made her move. A fresh launch, this time from my chest toward the blade. I turned with her, grabbing at her left arm as if to hold her back. She kicked at me without ever losing focus, stretching long, and just like that she had the knife, turning back, looming over me. The smile on her face? Feral. Happy. So Jacob wouldn't be the one to kill me after all. Interesting. Knife. Not going up, 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 what would be the fun in that, but instead twirling lazily in front of my eyes. She spoke again, whispers of death in her exotic tongue. No translation required to understand she was going to slice me up. and she was going to enjoy doing it.
Stop!
Jacob's hand, snapping around her wrist.
Give me that, stupid bitches!
She yelled at him, in English this time, demanded the right to finish what I'd started. I didn't speak. I didn't move. My heart was beating too fast. I lay on the floor, the fallen gazelle trapped between two lions.
She has her uses,
Jacob was arguing, the first time I'd heard him give me any credit.
Not for you to decide anyway. She's mine. Get your own plaything.
Then, after a long exchange that went over my fuzzy, blacking-out head, she was still sitting on my chest, a sudden change. The girl stood, removing her weight and allowing oxygen to come flooding back. She tucked away the knife, but still peered at me in triumph.
You, Jacob addressed me. You got work to do.
It took me a bit to sit up, climb shakily to my feet.
You attacked my daughter, he said.
Daughter?
Violated her hospitality. Now you gotta pay. She demands a tribute. Since she can't kill you, you gotta go out, find her a replacement toy.
I couldn't do it. I begged, pleaded. Jacob had tried before. Talk to that girl in that bar. Go chat up that woman in the corner. Bring her over to me. Before, I'd always been able to distract him. Have another beer. Let's go back to the rig. Let's put a new song on the jukebox. But now he was adamant. I would go out with him and his daughter. I would befriend a girl of their choosing, and I would introduce the woman to them. Or Jacob would leave me alone with his daughter and an entire collection of kitchen knives. For emphasis, she produced the knife, then slid the blade down my forearm, both of us staring in fascination as the blood welled to the surface. In the end, I caved. You tell yourself you will be strong. You tell yourself this is impossible, it can't get any worse. You even tell yourself you'd rather die. But the truth is, it's hard to give up on life. I don't know why. Surely giving up would have made more sense. I should have gone with my first instinct and slashed my wrists in the kitchen. But I hadn't. I didn't. I wanted to survive. And now, this. I bandaged Lindy's shoulder. I'd hit all bone, leaving a long but shallow groove across her shoulder blade. By morning, she wouldn't feel a thing. Only my terror would go on and on and on. She dressed in a deep purple, a shade so dark it was nearly black. I was given some of Lindy's clothes, a worn pair of jeans already falling off my bony hips, and a t-shirt tied beneath my breasts. Lindy had a car, a clunker to match her home. Jacob drove. Lindy sat with me in the back, gloating over what was to come.
How long have you lived here? I tried to ask. How often do you get to see your father?
I nearly tripped over the word father, but Lindy wouldn't talk. She had her eye on the prize, a fun night out on the town. The bar Jacob finally chose was a dive, a barely standing shack at the edge of a barely there beach advertising cheap beer, the kind of place that would make discerning patrons shudder and dedicated drunks cheer, the kind of place Jacob himself fit right in. Lindy stood out, too young, too beautiful in her purple-black dress and long, loose hair. Men stared at her in instant lust, women in instant hatred. She smirked at all of them, following her father through a maze of closely packed tables. In contrast to her, I went unnoticed. Too pale, too skinny, too all washed up. Not even a drunk, more like a heroin addict. I didn't know what else to do, so I followed them to the worn driftwood bar, earning points by association. Jacob ordered up shots of tequila. A round for all three of us, and an instant bloom of fire in my empty, shrunken stomach. I was glassy-eyed after the first shot, barely standing by the second, willing me into compliance, or an act of compassion, as Jacob knew I'd do what he said anyway. Nobody wants to be a monster. But some are still born that way. And others, with bleeding cuts down their arms and enough tequila in their stomachs, Lindy nudged my shoulder, her gaze darting to the corner. A woman sat there, eyes heavily made up, tube top barely containing her voluminous chest. She was not young and pretty, more like middle-aged and fleshy. A pro, I recognized by now, because bars like this attracted as many working girls as local drunks.
"Tell her we want to party," Lindy instructed me. "We know a place. We have the cash."
I didn't move, so Jacob shoved me. "You heard her. Go." I staggered back from the bar, having to focus hard to keep my footing, one step in front of the other, moving past the tables to the shadows in the corner, to the woman waiting there. She eyed me expectantly when I approached. Even for me it was hard not to stare at all the flesh spilling out from that much too tiny top. But I forced myself to find her eyes, to register they were hard and calculating. And also brown. Brown eyes. Like her mother's? Like her daughter's? Everyone is a person. Only I have become an object.
"Run,"
I heard myself say, my voice barely a whisper. Was I speaking to me? Was I speaking to her? Now was the time, the last moment of truth.
"Girl?"
she asked.
"My name is..."
"What is my name? Who am I?" "Molly."
"Not Molly.
A monster."
"Please go. Just leave. They...
I needed to say something. Very important. My head was spinning. Too much tequila, not enough food. I was going to be sick. Suddenly, Lindy was at my side, her hand squeezing my forearm where she'd sliced it earlier, squeezing hard.
"We're looking for a party," she practically purred. "A private party."
The woman agreed to come with us, her gaze going past us to rest on Jacob, the philosophical shrug of a woman who'd seen worse.
"All of you?" she asked, which nearly made me vomit.
"No," Lindy corrected her, "just the man. But I want to watch." The woman shrugging philosophically again.
"Don't do it," I wanted to tell her, but I couldn't find my voice. I couldn't find my will. I only knew how to survive. I didn't know how to save anyone else.
Jacob drove, headed to Lindy's house, and then... There was muffled screaming. It went on for a long time. There were grunts and groans, smacks and squeaks, all from a place I wouldn't go, a room I never saw. I sat outside Lindy's house, in the backyard, my arms wrapped tight around my head as if that would block the onslaught. Eventually I crawled far enough away to vomit up the tequila. Then I dry-heaved. Then I picked at the scab on my forearm, if only to distract myself by watching the cut bleed again. Hours later, Jacob walked out wearing jeans, nothing else, his white, flabby belly like an obscene growth. He smelled terrible, sweet and sour, sweat and sex. I would have thrown up again if I'd had anything left. He merely grunted, lit up a cigarette.
"Evening time, we'll take her out to the swamp. Let the gators do the hard work for us."
I said nothing. He squatted down, peered straight at me.
"If it hadn't been her, would have been you," he said.
"Brown eyes," I thought. "Like her mother's. Like her daughter's."
"Do you have any more children?" I heard myself ask. He laughed.
"Nah, just this one."
"Her mother."
"Hates my guts. Kept her away from me for years. But that's the thing about kids. They grow up, get a mind of their own. Now she wants to know her daddy. Can you believe it? All these years later?"
Jacob grinned in the dark.
"My little girl loves me."
Jacob rose to standing, stubbed out his cigarette.
"You know things now," he informed me. "Got your hands dirty yourself. No matter what happens, you're now one of us. Welcome to the club."
Chapter 36. My thin pine shard, meticulously peeled down to slip into the door jamb, splinters the second I try to use it to jimmy the door latch. I sit back on my heels in the dark, holding the remnants in my hand. I could try again, but what would be the point? The pine is soft and thin. The door is solid and heavy. Using one to pry open the other is never going to happen.
Behind me, the girl whimpers. I track the sound to the far left corner.
Yeah, I know, I say out loud, encouraging contact. I can't see her in the dark, which makes sound more important. Like mine, her hands are now free, her arms unrestricted. God only knows what she'll do next. Jump me from behind? Go for my throat? Just because she's a victim doesn't mean she's innocent. I know that well enough.
Survivors do what survivors must do in order to survive. Shut up, Samuel, I mutter out loud, which makes the girl whimper again.
I rise to standing, stretching out my arms, flexing my wrists, which feels good. Then I contemplate my options. No sound from outside. No shadowy movements in the viewing window. So far, the girl and I have been unshackled for at least 30 minutes, and there's been no response from the peanut gallery. Evil kidnapper doesn't realize we're on the loose yet, or doesn't care.
How did he get pine coffins in here without me ever waking? How did he snatch me out of my own apartment without me ever fighting?
Stop it, I order myself. Now is not the time to analyze the past. Now is the time to move forward.
Who's out there? I ask the girl as I roam our dark prison, searching for anything that might make a better crowbar than slivers of cheap wood. She doesn't talk.
Did you know Devon? I ask.
It takes me a minute to remember his full name, told to me forever ago while I was sitting in the back of a patrol car.
Devon Goulding. Bartender. Amazing pecs. Works at Tonic. Did you know him?
No more whimper. A sharp inhale. Recognition. I would swear it.
I killed him, I say, my voice just as conversational. I tossed antifreeze and potassium permanganate onto his head and shoulders. Chemical fire. Burned him alive.
Another shocked inhale.
Does that make you happy? To know that he suffered? That he's dead? Or do you miss him?
I don't mean for my voice to sound understanding, even wistful, but these things happen.
The man's dead?
Her voice sounds hoarse, but at least she's finally talking to me.
I didn't kidnap you, I say.
I don't know.
What do you mean you don't know? How can you not know what happened to you?
She doesn't answer. I should have stuck with understanding. Compassion is not my strong suit.
Tonic Nightclub, downtown Boston. Ring a bell?
I've come to the plastic bucket. I pick it up, heft it for weight. A metal handle would have been nice. Even a plastic one might have worked. But I'm not that lucky, which means there's nothing to harvest as a pry bar. What if I threw the bucket at the viewing window, went for shattering glass? I twist the bucket in my hands, already skeptical. It's too light, the one-way mirror no doubt being heavy-duty. I keep the bucket with me for now, however. If the girl rushes me, I can always use it to conk her over the head, Three Stooges style.
Tonic,
the girl whispers, as if recalling a name from another lifetime ago.
Black walls, blue lights, killer bands, I begin, then halt myself.
Black walls. Unbidden, I cross to the right until I hit one of the walls in question. Floor, wall, ceiling, windows, all covered in black paint. Could that be coincidence? Devon Goulding surprised me Friday night, the bartender with the amazing pecs suddenly appearing and taking out my initial target. And yet, regaining consciousness in his garage? He felt arrogant and inexperienced to me. A predator, sure, but this kind of predator? With a blacked-out room? Penchant for silk nighties and elaborate shackle system? Not to mention, I took him down, and yet here I am.
And yet, a nightclub famous for its blacked-out bar, and a room now covered entirely in black paint. Could that really be a coincidence?
Which makes me wonder what else I'd missed Friday night. Several of Stacy's friends had said they frequented Tonic as well as Birch's, not to mention the staff at both places were friendly with one another, getting off duty at one club to go grab drinks at the other, given the close proximity. In my mind, that made it worth checking out. After all, the staff at Birch's had been cleared in Stacy's disappearance, but what about the folks down the street at Tonic? Long shot, maybe, but apparently closer than I'd thought.
Birch's. I say out loud, just to see what kind of reaction I can get from my cellmate. She inhales again, her official sound of recognition.
"Stacy Summers," I state. She doesn't reply as much as she whimpers. Affirmation? Denial? What I'd give for the tiniest beam of light.
"Last thing you remember?" I ask her. She doesn't answer. I search my brain for a better approach. What did I remember in the beginning? Or perhaps, more accurately, what did I allow myself to still know? Because it's not like you magically forget your entire life, identity, the people who loved you. It's more like you box them up, put the images away. Because thinking of such things, knowing such things, is simply too hard. Those memories make you human, which is inconsistent with your current role as an inanimate object. And just because the police one day spring through the door, black armored beetles toting weapons and shouting orders, doesn't magically open up the mental attic. If anything, I locked down harder, as disoriented by freedom as I'd once been by life in a coffin-shaped box. I found the girl, stumbled upon her quite literally in my search for resources. She is curled up in the corner, my foot having tripped over her own. She flinches at the contact. I can feel her recoil, then, when there's no place for her to retreat, make herself smaller. It tugs at me. Another response I know too well, tried so many times myself. Except it never worked. Jacob always got his way in the end. Until that very last moment, his brains and blood in my hair. I kneel down. I keep my voice soft. "I dreamed of foxes," I whisper to this girl in the dark. "I dreamed I ran with them through the woods. I dreamed I was wild and free. And though I always woke up again, it felt good to dream." She doesn't answer. "It's okay, you know. Survivors do what survivors have to do. Samuel told me that. When we get out of here, I'll introduce you to him. You'd like him." Then, when she still doesn't respond, "You'll have bad nights after this. It's funny, you escape, but you never really get away. You don't realize what a comfort it is to go through life thinking, that will never happen to me, until, of course, that assurance is gone. And every story in the news, every article you read in the paper, all you can think is, that could be you. I studied, that's what I did. I learned self-defense, so next time a fat, sweaty piece of shit couldn't snatch me off the beach. I learned to pick locks, so I would never be shackled again. I rub my wrists, smile ruefully in the dark. At least that part worked. What I'm trying to say is, the fear never really goes away, but there are options. You can build a life. You can be a person again. Look at Elizabeth Smart, J.C. Dugard. There are success stories. I'm just not one of them. I don't say that. I don't want to demoralize her. And my failings don't have to be her own. My goal, my one mission in life, certainly isn't the stuff of happily ever afters. I only spoke it out loud once, 5 years ago. I leaned down and whispered my promise in Jacob's ear. I told him exactly what I was going to do one day. Right before I placed the barrel of the gun against the top of his head and pulled the trigger. His blood and brains in my hair. Not all of my dreams are nightmares. "Devin Goulding is dead," I test the waters one last time. "I know. I personally killed him." The girl finally speaks.
"You don't understand."
"I'm trying to."
"You shouldn't have hurt him."
"Had to. It was Friday night."
"Now, it will be worse."
"What will be worse?"
"Whatever happens next," she says quietly. "It will be much, much worse."
I leave her in the corner. I'm tired of doom and gloom. What I want is escape. I return to the mattress, encountering the spring coil I bent into my makeshift lockpick. I've been picturing in my head a long, flat object to jimmy open the door. Now I switch gears. Maybe a mattress coil would work. It's stiffer than the pine, and if I curved the end into the shape of a spoon, or one of those things used to dip hard-boiled eggs into coffee mugs of colored Easter dye, I've got nothing better to try. I wrestle with the mattress again, removing piles of foam and stuffing with my hands, releasing more musty herbal smells.
I sneeze several times, but soldier on. The coils are tied together. I can't see how in the dark, so I have to poke, prod, twist, and turn with fingertips that are already shredded and bloody. Converting the top of one coil into a lockpick was a far easier operation. This, trying to remove an entire spring, proves nearly impossible. Again, my kingdom for a single beam of light. If I could just see what I was doing. My bruised fingers start to feel heavy, numb. I'm tired. So very tired. I just want to lie down, get some sleep. I find my eyes dragging shut. I have to force them open. The stress is catching up with me. I'm hungry again, but without any sense of time, have no idea how long it's been since I last ate. Hungry. Thirsty. Water somewhere. I should take a nap. Except, of course, I still have to extract the damn coil. My eyes drifting closed. Fingers latching onto my shoulders, suddenly digging in. I jolt awake, twisting frantically, tossing back an elbow, but the girl, having finally roused herself, is surprisingly strong. "The mattress," she's saying. "You have to get away from the mattress. Away, away." I try to pull free, but my movements are too sluggish. Then, just as suddenly as she grabbed me, she lets me go. I collapse back, an ungainly beetle with my arms and legs in the air. I have to blink my eyes, concentrate to right myself. Even then I feel groggy, and I still want to sleep. "It's in the mattress," she says. "What's in the mattress?" I mutter. "I don't know, but the mattress? You'll sleep? It makes you sleep?" The mattress is drugged, or contaminated, or laced with something. That's what she's trying to tell me. I'd been right in the beginning. The room is booby-trapped, except it's not sleeping powder in the bottled water or some kind of knockout gas in the ventilation system. It's the mattress. "We need the mattress spring," I hear myself. "I got it out. It must be someplace near the top. We need it." The girl doesn't answer. She moves, dragging her feet in the dark. Her side, of course. She's still injured, and walking must be painful. But she doesn't complain as she shuffles back to the mattress, feels around with her hand. Then she's back. I feel the wire pressed against my arm. "I don't understand who you are," she says. "A girl, just like you. Except once upon a time, I escaped from the dark." "You can get us out of here?" "Yes." "Far, far away? I don't want to ever come back." "You're a survivor," I tell her, tell myself. "You can do anything." "I want to go home." "Tell me your name. You want to get out of here? You have to remember who you really are." It takes her a bit. I understand. I know how these things work. I've been there myself. Because it's one thing to survive. It is much, much harder to truly live.
"My name is Stacy Summers," she whispers, "and I just want to see my parents again."
I can't comment. My throat has closed up. There are too many things I want to say, and none of them are enough. Instead, I pick up the mattress coil. I work it with my poor bloody fingers, looping it around, folding it in on itself until it's a stiffer, spoonier version of itself. Then I find the door again. It takes me a bit to wiggle out the pieces of broken wood, then the edge is cleared, and it's just me, a jury-rigged mattress spring, and two girls' wildest dreams. Poke, wiggle, push, shimmy, again and again, and suddenly, almost imperceptibly, I can hear it. The tiniest, softest click of the latch suppressing in the lock plate. I push, very gently, almost timidly. The door moves. The door opens. I have no idea what will happen next.
Chapter 37. "We found Christy Kilker," Dee Dee informed her boss, Cal Horgan. "How certain?" 90%. "Ben identified a butterfly tattoo on her right shoulder blade. Mother confirmed Christy has the same. Dental records will be the slam dunk, but we're fairly confident the remains are Christy Kilker." "What about Stacy Summers?" "I don't know. Wasn't there a second girl? Another license you found in the Goulding kid's bedroom?" "Natalie Draga from Alabama. Don't know about her either." "Flora Dane?" Horgan asked.
So, Dee Dee reported, we found Christy Kilker.
And one out of four ain't bad?
Horgan arched a brow at her. She scowled. Her boss switched gears.
Any theories of the crime?
The perpetrator favors glittered hair gel.
Seriously?
Actually, I have no idea. We're still waiting for the lab reports on our various samples, but we found gold glitter outside Flora's apartment, as well as on Christy's hair, as well as in the bathroom at the nightclub Tonic.
Tonic.
Devin Goulding worked there, same with Natalie Draga until her own disappearance. As for the other missing persons, they have frequented the nightclub, including Stacy Summers. Her friends confirmed they went there on occasion, and two of them shared that information with Flora Dane.
Horgan folded his hands across his stomach, which would seem to confirm that Devin Goulding was behind all the girls' disappearances, including Stacy Summers's.
Dee Dee hesitated.
Spit it out, detective.
We didn't find anything in Goulding's place to tie him to Stacy Summers. Why keep trophies of two victims but not the third?
She was higher profile, and he was caught on tape abducting her. That might have spooked him.
I don't think that's how these guys work. I think trophies fall under the compulsive part of their behavior. Plus, where's Stacy's body? Where's Natalie's body? Why did we find one but not the other two?
Horgan studied her.
Then, of course, there's the matter of Flora Dane, Dee Dee continued, who disappeared after Goulding died. Except in her case, we don't even know that she was abducted. It's possible she simply walked away. Not probable, but possible.
What do you know again?
Her boss asked her.
Good news, sir. We found Christy Kilker's body.
Dee Dee was having that kind of day. That kind of case, really. She retreated to her office and the growing pile of paperwork stacking up on her desk. She stared at the reports, tried to tell herself to be a good restricted duty sergeant. Sit, read, dot I's, cross T's, manage. Perhaps somewhere in that mound of files the next clue awaited. But she didn't believe it. This case didn't give up information. It took away common sense.
Knocking.
She looked up from her desk to discover Keen standing in her doorway, impeccably clad, as always, and bearing a burnished brown leather attaché. She would never call it a merce, at least not to his face.
"Where's Rosa?" Dee Dee asked.
"If I were a betting man, I'd say in a kitchen somewhere, baking.
Have you allowed her access yet to Flora's apartment?"
"She paid a visit this morning, as I'm sure you know, but crime scene techs aren't ready to release the scene."
Keynes nodded, moved into her office. He was wearing his cashmere coat.
She should stand, take it from him, offer a glass of water. She couldn't bring herself to do anything. She simply sat there, waiting.
"It's the nightclub Tonic," she stated abruptly.
Whatever happened to those girls, Tonic had something to do with it. And Devin Goulding.
"Which reminds me, I'm really angry with Flora. I was peeved when I first arrived at the Goulding crime scene. Now I'm pissed. She never should have killed him. Devin, alive, could answer all of our questions. Devin dead, completely worthless. When we find Flora, I plan on charging her with at least half a dozen offenses, just to feel better."
Keynes removed his coat, hung it on the coat rack in the corner, took a seat.
"My professional opinion?"
he offered.
"By all means."
The manager, Jocelyn F.E.A., had a relationship with Devin Goulding.
"Seriously? That's all you got? I'm just a city cop, and I figured out that much. Woman scorned, practically had it tattooed on her forehead."
Keynes shrugged. "She lied. The question is, did she lie because she was embarrassed, or because she has something more to hide?"
"Yet another question to contemplate in the small hours of the morning. The problem is, we have too many questions. We need information. Fresh, tangible clues."
"Which is why I'm here."
"You brought me a fresh, tangible clue?"
"I brought you information. Regarding Jacob Ness."
"Jacob Ness is dead."
"Yes," Keynes agreed. "But his daughter isn't."
"What's relevant about this information is that Flora never provided it."
"What do you mean?"
Dee Dee asked. "I debriefed Flora while she was recovering in the hospital. She struck a deal. She would tell her story one time to one person, then never again.
She chose me for the honor. Then she talked and talked and talked. 472 days she had much to tell, and yet for every story, every horror, every revelation, I would never say I know everything that happened between Flora and Jacob. For each anecdote Flora revealed, I could tell there were others she held back. That's not atypical with survivors. They're traumatized, shell-shocked, and, in many cases, guilt-stricken. Because they survived? Or because of what they did in order to survive? Take your pick. Either way, guilt is guilt. Didi leaned forward. The lead FBI agent, Kimberly Quincy, mentioned she still had questions about everything that occurred during Flora's captivity. Something about other traces of hair, DNA belonging to other women, recovered from a box he had in the back of his rig. Flora would not be the first kidnapping victim coerced into helping target other victims. True. Do you know what the hardest part about survival is, Detective? I'm sure you'll tell me. Living with it. Every rescued person I've ever debriefed, they were so sure if they could just escape, just get through the ordeal, they'd never complain, never want, never suffer again. My primary job is helping them understand that won't be the case. Survival isn't a destination. It's a journey. And most of the people I help, they're still getting there. Killing off one perpetrator at a time? Didi asked dryly, considering Flora's crime spree. 472 days, much of it locked in a coffin. Do you really think you could handle it any better? Didi scowled. She didn't have an answer for that, and they both knew it. So, the daughter. The FBI recovered many samples from Jacob's hotel room and his long-haul rig. As SAC Quincy revealed, we found DNA evidence belonging to others. One sample was identified as being female and bearing markers consistent with Jacob himself. In other words, a daughter. You found DNA from Jacob's own daughter? In the wooden box? From cigarette butts littered on the floor of the rig. Keynes lifted his leather attaché, extracting a file. Didi took it, then, glancing down at her desk, realized she was officially out of room for new paperwork. "Who is she?" Didi asked, finally positioning the file crossways on another stack of God knows what. We never figured out. The DNA didn't match with anything in the system. Agents ran down birth certificates, etc., but never found any records bearing Jacob's name. Of course, it's possible he was never listed as the father, and since we don't have an approximate age, it's hard to be more exact in our search of hospital databases. Assuming the hospitals have computerized all their old records, many small rural hospitals haven't. What about following up with Jacob's known love interests, checking with them about a possible child? The Devon Goulding problem, Keane said. It took Didi a second, then she got it. You mean Flora killed Jacob, meaning you can't ask him for a list of prior relationships. Girl's good at tying up loose ends. Jacob Ness flew under the grid for most of his life. A brief stint in prison, but other than that he was a loner, driving from state to state in his big rig, his only permanent address being his mother's house in Florida. According to Flora, in the beginning at least, she was kept in a basement room. There are basements in Florida? It's primarily slab construction, which makes us believe Jacob left the state almost immediately after the kidnapping. He mentioned to Flora that they were in the mountains of Georgia, but we've never been able to pinpoint an exact location. When Jacob worked, his movements were tracked by a computer system used by all long-haul truckers. Jacob was an independent contractor, however, and he spent weeks at a time not working at all. During those periods, we don't know where he went. According to Flora, he had a penchant for crashing at cheap motels in small southern towns, but we've never been able to retrace all of his movements. More questions he can't answer and she won't tell? I don't know if Flora has the answers, Keane said bluntly. Hard to get your bearings, locked in a box. Good point. We know Jacob moved around, mostly in the south. We know he didn't return to his mother's house during the time he had Flora. But we also know, at some point, he met up with his daughter, Happily, unhappily, we have no idea. What's Flora's official position?
Jacob was partial to prostitutes. She doesn't know anything about a daughter.
He had his own personal sex slave and he was still hiring prostitutes?
Jacob Ness was a sex addict. Claimed it wasn't his fault he was a monster.
Dee Dee didn't have words for that. She could tell by the hard